Hello, and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Rabbi Schweiger discusses Parshiyot Matot v'Maaseh. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member of Pardes and serves as Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
This week's parsha is a double portion. Parshiyot Matot v'Maaseh, the last two parshiot of the book of Bamidbar. I would like to examine chapter 35, the section dealing with cities of refuge and unintentional murder. There are three sections in the Chumash which speak about cities of refuge. Our parsha, Dvarim chapter 4, and then later on in Dvarim chapter 19. I would like to see the three sections, how they complement each other. What are the laws of the cities of refuge? And what is the philosophy behind the law? Let us begin with our parsha. In chapter 35, verse 6, it says, "And the cities that you will give to the Levites, six cities of refuge, which you will give to them, where the murderer will flee, and in addition you will give them 42 cities." Based on the phraseology of this verse, the rabbis derive that all 48 cities of the Levites are in fact cities of refuge. By juxtaposing the 42 to the 6, the rabbis say, just as the 6 give asylum, so too the other 42. What makes the 6 cities unique? Number 1, they provide asylum, even in situations where the murderer does not seek it. Even if the murderer is unaware that he is currently in a city of refuge, automatically it provides asylum for him. Number 2, the Levites are obligated to provide free housing to the murderers who come to the cities of refuge. Both of these laws are somehow trying to make it easier on the murderer to be able to be in the city of refuge and to be able to get that asylum. Where are these cities? In chapter 35, verse 14, "Three cities you shall designate on the eastern side of the Jordan, and three cities you shall designate in the land of Canaan." And in the previous verse, 13, "Six cities of refuge they shall be to you." We know from Dvarim, chapter 4, verse 43, that Moshe, in his lifetime, designated the three cities on the eastern side of the Jordan. In Deuteronomy 4, 43, "Betzer, in the desert, in the plain, in the land of Reuven; Ramot, in the Gilad, in the portion of Gad; Golan, in the Bashan, in the portion of Manasseh." And in the book of Joshua, we see how Joshua designated the three cities on the western side of the Jordan: Kedesh, in the portion of Naphtali; Shechem, in the portion of Ephraim; Hebron, in the portion of Yehuda. In Dvarim, chapter 19, verse 3, it says, "Prepare to you the way. Divide up the border of your land, which God is giving you." And the rabbis derive from this verse that signs would be posted along the roads, directing murderers to the cities of refuge. The cities were apportioned in such a way that they were equidistant from each other and from the borders of the land. And in fact, the cities in the western part paralleled the cities in the east. Kedesh was opposite Golan, Shechem opposite Ramot, and Hebron opposite Betzer. Once again, the laws are trying to facilitate access to the cities of refuge to enable the murderer to seek asylum. Who is the city of refuge for? If we go back to our section, chapter 35, verse 12, the city shall be as an asylum from the avenger of the blood, so that the murderer will not die until he is brought before the court for judgment. According to the rabbinic understanding, all murderers would immediately run to the city of refuge to get asylum in order to receive a fair trial. The court would have to determine what was the nature of the murder. And in fact, if we go back to verse 12, chapter 35, verse 12, essentially the cities of refuge are for those who kill unintentionally. Those who deliberately murder, in the language of the text, who stalk their prey, are tried and should be given capital punishment. But those who killed unintentionally are to be given asylum in the cities of refuge. As it says in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 6, lest the avenger of the blood will be in hot pursuit of the murderer and reach him, because the path, the way is far, and kill him. But that shouldn't happen, because there is no death sentence on the murderer, because he was not an enemy of the victim from yesterday, from the day before. And that is why it is important to have the cities of refuge. The murderer is to remain in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. That is what we're told in our section, chapter 35, verse 28. He will settle in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest, and only after the death of the high priest shall the murderer return to the land of his possession. And if we backtrack for a moment, the murderer must surely remain within the borders of the city of refuge. Chapter 35, verse 27. If he goes beyond the border and the avenger of the blood finds him and he kills him, the avenger of the blood will not be held accountable for what happened. It will not be considered murder. There is a kind of ambivalent position over here to the one who kills unintentionally. On the one hand, the Torah is providing a city of refuge to protect him. And yet at the same moment, the Torah is also allowing the avenger of the blood to kill him. It would seem to be that on a certain level, the unintentional murderer should be put to death. But it cannot be done by the court of law. So it is put in the hands of the avenger of the blood to do it. And yet in the very same moment, the Torah ultimately does not want to see the murderer killed and feels that that may be exaggerated as a punishment for him. And hence we have the cities of refuge. What is unintentional murder. On the one hand, it is not deliberate. It is not a result of stalking. On the other hand, it is also not an accident. And there is extensive discussion in the Talmud to define a whole variety of situations to be able to ascertain what exactly is the situation of unintentional murder. If we were to step back for a moment and think about our modern context, the area where this becomes so pronounced is the context of road accidents. At what point is it an accident? At what point is it negligence? At what point is it negligence that borders on premeditation? I think we would all agree that drunk driving is something that borders on premeditation. But what about speeding? What about tailgating? What about passing across a white line? What about driving when you're exhausted and you're dozing off at the wheel? According to the rabbinic understanding, unintentional murder involves an element of negligence. It's something that could have been foreseen, could have been anticipated, and hence could have been prevented. It's a situation where somebody is perhaps so absorbed in what they're doing that they're oblivious to the world around them, oblivious to the potential danger which they could cause. Someone is building, and there is an open manhole that could have been covered up. Someone falls in. There are numerous situations in our day-to-day life where potentially people could be unintentional murderers. The Talmud raises a very interesting question. Why is it that there are three cities of refuge on the eastern side of the Jordan and three cities of refuge on the western side? It's disproportionate. There are only 2.5 tribes on the eastern side. There are 9.5 on the western. Hence, there should be more cities of refuge in the land of Canaan. And the answer, based on a verse from the prophets, Gilad is an area filled with murderers. Because it is filled with murderers, there's a greater need for cities of refuge. But what's the correlation? When it says of Gilad being filled with murderers, we're talking about intentional murderers. Cities of refuge are aimed at unintentional. And the answer is, what is the culture of the society, the climate, in a society which tolerates, even worse maybe, encourages intentional murder? There is no question that there will be a high incidence of unintentional murder. To what degree does the society see the sacredness of human life and see murder as being a horrific crime which cannot be understood, which cannot be tolerated? The end of our section addresses this point when it says in chapter 35, verse 30, anyone who kills on the basis of witnesses should be put to death. Do not take any ransom, any substitute, in lieu of putting the murderer to death, because he is an evil person, and he should surely die. Do not take any ransom in lieu of the murderer fleeing to the city of refuge, the unintentional murderer, in order to enable him to just go settle in his land. But he needs to be in the city of refuge until the death of the priest. And in verse 33 and 34, do not make the land hypocritical, according to the Aramaic translation, unkelos. Do not implicate the land. Do not make it evil. Because blood which is spilled is a stain, is a blotch on the land. And the land will not be atoned for the blood which is spilled in its midst, except for the blood, by taking the blood of the one who spilled it. Do not defile the land where you are settled, where I dwell in it, because I am Hashem, who dwells in the midst of the Jewish people. The Torah, in the most emphatic terms, speaks of how murder is not to be tolerated, is not to be poo-pooed, where the perpetrators need to be brought to justice, where the society has to realize that what has happened cannot exist. It is a blotch on the society. It is a defilement of the land. The first story of murder, Cain and Abel. When God approaches Cain, God says to Cain, the voice of your brother's blood is crying out from the ground. The imagery of the ground being defiled by the blood, of the land seeking justice, of the land seeking atonement. If we look at that story for one moment, it is very interesting that the punishment of Cain is exile. I want to look at this for one moment in our story, in our law. Why, in fact, is the unintentional murderer exiled to the city of refuge? There are two ways of looking at it. One way is to see this as a punishment. How can he possibly go on with his day-to-day routine when he has done such a horrific crime that cannot be reversed? And it's important to note that when someone's life is taken, it is not only an injury to that individual, but to all of the concentric circles surrounding that individual, family and friends, job acquaintances, colleagues. There is a tremendous amount of collateral damage. There is a tremendous amount of upheaval, disruption that's occurred. There's a certain element here of measure for measure. The unintentional murder disrupted the lives of many people. His life is now disrupted. There was a certain break of continuity. He is now breaking the continuity of his ancestral portion. Murder sometimes is an expression of empowerment. Empowerment at the expense of the other. Exile creates a sense of vulnerability, which then leads me into the next thing. That going to the city of refuge is not only a punishment, but it is educational. the city of refuge is a corrective. Number one, if murder is the result of a certain preoccupation with self, with a sense of empowerment, going to the city of refuge is a humbling experience. And not only that, but because the murderer is now vulnerable and at any moment could be killed by the Avenger of the Blood, this can be a very important balance that can create a much healthier way of looking at oneself and of eventually becoming integrated into society. Beyond that, the rabbis say that the cities of refuge were bubbles, idyllic frameworks, which could facilitate the transformation, the spiritual growth of the murderer. They were not to be too big, they were not to be too small. They were to provide all the basic needs of the murderer. And perhaps most important, they were Levite cities. Levites who are educators, who can perhaps be the one to instruct the murderers into a different path. Now let me add, the murderer is to remain there until the death of the high priest. And once again, the rabbis say, what is the connection to the high priest? And an answer which is given is, on some level, the high priest is accountable for what is going on, for this breakdown in society. The role of the priests, and in particular the high priest, is to bring about atonement, to be preoccupied with life, to bring about a new lease on life for individuals and for the society. There's a certain dissonance in the juxtaposition of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and the murderer, in that the role of the Kohen is to increase life. The act of the murderer just diminished life. How could such a thing have happened? Evidently, the high priest is not creating a certain culture, is not providing a role model that filters down to the all aspects of the society. And on some level, he is accountable. And perhaps when there are murderers, it is a red light to the high priest to get his act together. It's not just enough to say, to buy off the murderers and ask them and plead with them, don't pray for the death of my son. But more importantly, it is the priests who have to go through an introspective process to ask themselves, what is going on? How could this have happened in our midst? And we actually see a parallel in Dvarim, in chapter 21, in the section known as Egla Arufa. The calf whose back of the neck is severed. The whole expiation ceremony, when a dead body is found near a city and is not known who the murderer is, and the city, and especially the elders of the city, need to go through this cathartic experience to be able to affirm, our hands did not spill this blood. As I mentioned earlier, there are many situations where unintentional murders can happen. I mentioned earlier road accidents. There could be situations in hospitals of malpractice or short of malpractice. Care which is insufficient, perhaps neglect, that brought about the death of someone. Both as individuals and as members of society, we have to ask ourselves, how sacred is human life to us? How much do we really take care in the numerous things that we do to safeguard the lives of others? Or how much are we preoccupied with our own lives that we become oblivious to the other? It is clear from the end of our section that God expects us to create a society where the presence of God dwells. But for that presence to dwell, we need to recognize the presence of God in every individual around us. We need to see their lives as being precious. It is not enough to not take one's life. It is important for us to actively seek out the well-being of the other's life, and to do everything that we can to prevent the loss of that life. We are now in the midst of the 3 weeks. The 3 weeks which commemorate the destruction of the temple. Beginning with Shivasar B'Tammuz, which commemorates the breaching of the walls of the city, culminating in the destruction of the temple on Tisha B'Av. The breaching of the walls is a metaphor for the breaches in society, for the divisions of society. If the period of the 3 weeks is not just to be some sort of nostalgic commemoration, but is to be an impetus for the future, then we have to be able to see this as a time of introspection, as a time of healing, as a time of affirming how much each one cares about the other, how unintentional murder has no place in our midst. If we are able to learn from the lessons of the past, we can create a much better future and hopefully create a reality where the presence of God will once again walk in our midst. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.